Welcome to the HBS Cast. I'm your host, Colbert Cannon. We've reached the end of our ninth season, so today we're taking a listen back to our best moments. This season, I had the pleasure of speaking with thought leaders across industries, from entrepreneurs turned VC backers to organizational psychologists, as well as chief investment officers from leading pensions and global insurers. The common thread through all of our guests this season was their ability to distill each step of their journey into a meaningful lesson that we can all use in business and in life. Their stories go a long way to support the ethos of the HBS Cast, that our achievements do not happen in a vacuum. It's the mentors who help us along the way, the storms that we weather in downturns, and the inflection points that we later look back on that are the true sum of our success. The team here at HBS is so grateful to all of our guests for sharing their expertise and wisdom with us on the pod. And thank you to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We're taking a quick break, but season 10 is already in the works. We wish you a very happy holiday season, and we'll be back in the new year with more great conversations. Without further ado, listen on to hear a recap of the key lessons we gleaned from another fantastic run. We opened season 9 with Alexa Von Tobel, CEO of Inspired Capital. Alexa built Inspired Capital, a venture capital firm, and LearnVest, a financial literacy company, from the ground up. She shared one of her biggest takeaways from the founder's seat. When I talk to entrepreneurs, you always learn so much in that first 6 months, 12 months, as you say, everybody's saying no. What do you take with you from that experience?
The best conversations were actually the most brutal ones. It was times where, and I always tell people, take your five smartest people in your life, go find them and pitch your idea to them, and then be quiet and say, please shred my idea, destroy it. What am I missing? What's not going to work? And so I think the biggest thing, if you're an entrepreneur, is you need to take feedback really well and actually embrace it. And not everyone's feedback is going to be right. So you have to get really good at knowing what advice to take and what advice to ignore.
We were joined by my colleague, Mark Rubenstein, Managing Director at HPS Investment Partners and Head of Strategic Investment Partners North America's team. Mark shared his view on embracing risk and complexity. You mentioned one of the factors that would lead you to a private solution is complexity, right? But sometimes I worry that somebody hears complexity and thinks risk. Those are actually two different things. Like, what is complexity from an HBS perspective when you look at saying, oh, this is an HBS kind of deal because we can understand this one? What does that mean?
Sure. I think it's easy to build a portfolio by saying, here are the industries or types of companies we've invested in historically, but you will miss out on the diamonds and the rough. And I think we've always embraced complexity from the founding days of the firm. And I think when you do that deep dive due diligence, you can come up with some pretty special transactions. To give you some historical examples, in 2010, in the early days, we financed an SPV that funded the conversion of most of the movie theaters in the United States from analog to digital equipment. And it was an extremely complicated transaction. We effectively had an SPV that was structuring take-or-pay style contracts with the entertainment companies. It was a transaction that took about a year to structure. So it was very complex, but from a risk-adjusted return standpoint, you could wrap your head around making a very significant premium to the actual risk that you were taking.
We learned about the impact of broadening access to alternative investments for independent financial advisors with Matt Brown, CEO of Case Group, a fintech platform devoted to bridging that gap.
Let's talk about the evolution of your business and the growth of it. So as you say, you have had a 15-year run here. There's been certain tailwinds to that that have helped you, right? There's been a massive growth in alternatives during that period of time. Why is that? Why do you think there's been such a tailwind for the alternative space?
First of all, financial advisors, they now have access to alternatives, but they're quite disappointed with this outcome of the 60-40 portfolio. So to add alts and create a modern three-dimensional portfolio of equities, fixed income, and alternatives is just delivering better outcomes for their clients. And they can see that. So they're drawn to that. Firms are also contributing to this narrative, diversifying shareholder base with wealth management assets. And that's newer to the equation. 5-8 years ago, when I'd have conversations with asset management firms, they were very institutionally focused in terms of their capital base. Now, wealth management is a main event. It's a huge pool of capital that's largely untapped, about to allocate to alts for the first time.
Grishma Parekh, co-head of North American Core Senior Lending and a driving force in direct lending here at HPS, shared her perspective on private credit investing. So tell me this, you've been doing private credit, you know, really since 2007, which is to say you've been part of the modern evolution of direct lending as a business, as an asset class. Sitting here now, how has that changed? Like, how's the market evolved? And how do you, you know, think about that over the last, you know, 15 or so years?
Yeah, I mean, it's a truly institutional global asset class in a way that in 2007, you certainly couldn't imagine. You know, 2 or 3 years ago, I don't think you could have imagined the sheer size of the asset class. But sort of more than that, the type of companies it would actually be relevant to. And what I mean by that is the asset class sort of started as being a solution provider to middle market companies. These were, you know, depending on how you defined it, but these were companies that were generating earnings of 20 million to 60 or 75 million. And thereafter, most companies would sort of, quote, graduate into an institutional market, the institutional public credit markets, where they were able to get more liquidity, better terms, better pricing, so on and so forth. What has happened over the course of the last 2 years is the private credit market is truly disintermediating the public credit markets in a meaningful way. And the size of deals that we are able to finance is several billion dollars and really grows with the passage of every quarter or two. And that's something that I think I certainly could never have predicted, you know, over the last several years would occur with this asset class.
We had the absolute pleasure of speaking with John Amici, OBE, an organizational psychologist and founder of APS Intelligence. John shared his insights on how companies can drive employee retention by creating sustainable and truly supportive workplaces. You know, culture is something we at HPS think a lot about, and I don't think it just happens. I think firms have to have intentionality around it. How do you advise companies on creating and sustaining a strong culture?
We normally start with something quite ordinary, and it seems simple. We audit people's websites and their careers page. Because most of the time, who you think you are as an organization is demonstrated on your website through your values, through the images that you choose to use, through the narratives that you have on the careers page, especially that talk to those who are not yet part of the organization. And we look at it, and then we do what we call this cascade map. So instead of starting and saying your culture is terrible, we just say, in order to achieve this culture that you're talking about, you say this is what you are all about. You say your manager will take an interest in your career. And so what we do is we say, here's the cascade map of what that actually means. Because it means if you're a utilization culture, if you're a, you know, heavy billing culture, does anybody really think taking an interest in a career is like twice yearly appraisal? So that means there has to be actual spots for you to have substantive conversations with these people. And if you're a manager with 10 direct reports, that's 10 hour-long conversations and not just once a year. But it's also, it's not just the time. You've got to have skills, like coaching conversation skills.
What are you actually doing with that time? Exactly.
And so this cascade map, it helps other people to see, helps our clients to see, not what we insist is the way forward, but in order for what they say to be true, to reduce that gap. And the reason that's important is because attrition, everybody knows that we've got this issue. I think it's really poorly named, quiet quitting. But quiet quitting and people leaving jobs and turnover is high, churn is high. That's happening in part because the gap between what is promised to an individual and their actual experience is widening. And while that happens, people will always look elsewhere. So it's a really practical thing we want to do with culture. It's not just, oh, wouldn't it feel better? It's let's be more high performing. Let's have more pro-social behavior from people. Let's have more engagement from people. Let's have better behaviors around risk, because we know that psychologically safe environments are much better for reducing risk events. So all of this is what we want to achieve.
We got some bedrock principles for investing through tough times with Amelia Wiener, the Chief Investment Officer at TIAA, an asset management firm focused on providing pension plans for educators. She talks specifically about the importance of covenants when it comes to private credit. For our listeners who are less familiar, why does, when something goes wrong, the caliber of your document, the covenants that you have or don't have, the protections of asset collateral, why does that matter?
Yeah, so I think of it as the ability to get to the table to negotiate with your partners, because if the other lenders to the company are at the table, they're looking to protect their downside risk as well. And they're looking to recover as much as they can from the situation. And because it's obviously not working out well, there's a fixed pie that everyone's going to have to share. And so if you're not at the table, you get a lesser recovery. And because covenants allow you to bring yourself to the table, give you a voice at those times, that's when you're able to negotiate better outcomes for yourself in a private credit deal. It is so different from public investing, which is more thematic. It's more macro, if you will. Yes, you're doing underwriting, but you're really understanding industries more than you are individual credits. What makes a credit work and what doesn't make it? Is it salvageable? Is it not salvageable? Should it be liquidated? Should it be restructured? Lots of questions that come up and lessons to learn from that.
I briefly handed over my hosting duties to my colleague Hugh Lawson, a managing director here at HPS, for a special episode of the HPS Cast. We featured his conversation with Maud Texier, the Global Director of Clean Energy and Decarbonization Solutions at Google, about the company's goal to use only carbon-free energy by 2030 and how the Inflation Reduction Act could help Google and other companies.
Many of us have heard about the Inflation Reduction Act. It's a pretty massive subsidy to stimulate the creation of clean energy in the United States. And we're actually, by the way, seeing a tremendous amount of opportunity of people wanting to build factories and create jobs and generate these parts. But how important has the IRA been to Google's procurement?
The IRA has been a big accelerator for us, especially as we think about this next generation of type of assets and technologies. When we started the program in 2019, 2020, and we were asking around for, do you have green hydrogen or long duration energy batteries? It was very hard for us to get any tangible projects. And people were very worried around economics and is it really going to be a strong market signals? And we're kind of like a little bit lonely, I would say, over there looking for projects. With the IRA, this has been a massive game changer because there's been such stimulus around those new technologies. And there's been a big push in also creating hubs. So for instance, in the US, you might hear about carbon capture hubs or green hydrogen hubs and really helping with those economies of scale. So today for us, it helped a lot finding the supply and the projects that we need to find by 2030. I would say, though, even though the infrastructure investment piece of that is present today, one of the key feedback that we're hearing from a lot of those projects is they still need the commercial off-takers on the other side. And one challenge that we have as Google, for instance, is even though we're big, we're still not going to take off a 1 gigawatt green hydrogen power plant by yourself. So this is where you need to create this market demand and market signal. And how can you aggregate? How can you partner with other industrials, for instance, to create this market signal?
We were joined by Francesco Martorana, the Group Chief Investment Officer at Generale, for a deep dive into Italy's largest insurer. Francesco shared how he manages a roughly 400 billion euro portfolio and how private credit factors into their asset allocation. So you talked about the breadth of your organization. You oversee the entire, you know, investment portfolio, but I'm curious about our business, private credit. I'd be interested to hear your perspective on private credit as an asset class at this point in the market cycle.
Actually, when it comes to private credit, first to put things into context, today approximately 7% of our portfolio in general account is allocated to private credit. This is at NAV invested, capital invested, a bit more if we take into account the commitments. Actually, this is more or less 40% of our private asset portfolio, because we do have also private equity, real estate equity, and real estate debt. When we look in private debt, essentially we have three classes. We have direct lending, real estate debt, and infrastructure debt, broadly speaking. And our objective is to have direct lending in our strategic asset allocation representing 50% more or less of our private debt allocation, and the rest going into real estate and infra debt. So when we look at the asset class, we look at it as a way to provide yield enhancement, because clearly we want to extract some illiquidity premium, complexity premium, and also, of course, a bit of credit risk premium. That is the first objective. The second one is to provide a bit of diversification in terms of interest rate risk, due to the floating nature. Of course, being mainly a life insurer, the vast majority of our bond portfolio is fixed rate. And so we have obviously a certain level of duration in the assets. And in a period like this, the private debt portfolio is giving us some upside in terms of repricing to higher interest rates. And then there is real estate and infrastructure. We also see this as, to a certain extent, a safer part of credit compared to traditional corporate credit.
Thanks again to our guests for joining me this season. We'll be back at the top of 2024 with all new episodes. Until then, I encourage you to check out any episodes you might have missed, or you can also visit our show notes to find links to all of our best ideas. This podcast was brought to you by At Will Media with HPS Investment Partners. Please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. See you in the new season. The opinions expressed on this podcast are that of the host, Colbert Cannon, and the guest of each episode, and do not necessarily reflect the views of HPS Investment Partners.